You're listening to the Product Podcast from Product School, featuring the best product leaders from Silicon Valley and beyond. If you're an aspiring product manager looking for your first PM role, or an experienced PM looking to level up your skills and advance your career, visit productschool.com to learn about our certifications and how we'll get you there. In this episode, join us for a dynamic discussion as we explore the journey into the tech industry and the varied roles of product managers. Our special guest, Saurabh Abhyankar, Chief Product Officer at MicroStrategy, shares real-world experiences and unveils the secrets to successful transitions, building a strong professional community, and mastering the skills essential in the dynamic tech landscape. Gain exclusive insights into his remarkable career journey and the challenges and triumphs of the role.
Hey, everyone. This is Carlos. I'm the founder and CEO at Product School. And today I'm here with Saurabh Abhyankar, who is the Chief Product Officer at MicroStrategy. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Carlos. How are you doing?
Good to see you again. I'm doing good, thank you. And I'm proud to have you on the show because we've been partnering with MicroStrategy over the years. And this is the first time we have someone from your company here at the podcast.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
It always makes things more fun when people get to learn the humans behind the product. And you are their Chief Product Officer. So maybe we can start from the top and tell us more about what MicroStrategy does.
Yeah, sure. So MicroStrategy is a business intelligence company and now a Bitcoin development company. We've been in business now for about 35 years. And so our founding principle was to try to bring information and intelligence to as many enterprise organizations as possible. And we've got really some of the most amazing brands around the world that use our software to help them, you know, take advantage of the data that they have, analyze their data, get their data out to both their own internal employees and their customers on the shop floor and in the boardroom.
Data, keyword. And you mentioned you've been around, your company's been around for over 35 years. So
yep.
I'm very curious to know what data looked like back in the day.
Well, I wasn't actually around working with the data 35 years ago. I hope I don't look like I was, but it was very different. Obviously, if you go back to the early 90s, there was really kind of no internet even at the time, right? And so it was on-premise, it was like pre-Windows, pre-graphical. And so you had information stored in, you know, all kinds of different mainframes and databases. But the problem at the time is that the world was evolving from very transactional operational scenarios to trying to unlock data and figure out, you know, how can we use data for strategic purposes? And that's actually where the name comes from, right? How do you, you know, actually unlock data for strategic purposes? And, you know, obviously Michael Saylor founded the company 35 years ago. And ever since we've been on that mission. And data has changed, and the way you store data has changed, the way you analyze data has changed. But at the end of the day, the goal of helping people do their jobs better, run their businesses better, serve their employees and their customers better, that still remains a core part of what we do.
And the role of product as a function has changed. I don't think it even existed 35 years ago. So I'm also curious to know how your target persona has evolved and who are they and how product teams make the most out of MicroStrategy today.
Yeah, so I guess that there's lots of parts to that question. The product organization has evolved quite a bit as well. There was no such thing as a chief product officer 30 years ago. Even product management as a discipline has evolved, changed a lot over 30 years. I mean, you know this, you've been doing this for a while as well. In fact, a lot of times there isn't a clear definition of product management and the product organization. It's kind of different in different companies. But I guess your question really more is about, you know, how do product people leverage MicroStrategy in their products? And oftentimes, if you think about most of the products that people manage, they have a specific goal, right? They're an ERP product. They have an operational goal. They're typically not analytics products. And so maybe you've built a call center application or something like this. But very quickly, people that start adopting that product want more and more analytics. And it usually starts by, you know, simple embedded reporting. You add a report, you build it by hand, and then some embedded visualizations. And you quickly realize that your users and your customers are asking for like a million additional ways of looking at the data. And once you start seeing that, you get this big, long product backlog of analytics requirements. And that's really where MicroStrategy comes in from an OEM and an embedded perspective.
It still blows my mind the amount of companies that are built on spreadsheets, the amount of products that are trying to replace or create a better version of the spreadsheet, because the spreadsheet serves a pretty generic use case and it can go long, but at some point you max it out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's always been the thing, right? Is you've got spreadsheets all across the organization and there's good use for spreadsheets. I think spreadsheets are fantastic for planning. They're actually a pretty decent way to get data from one place to another. People import and export using Excel all the time. But really, if you want to operationalize information, so for example, if you're running hundreds of stores or hospitals or banks or anything out there in the world that's at scale, and you want to get, you know, useful, actionable information out to all of those people, a spreadsheet is definitely not going to scale very well in that scenario.
And I think the role of the product person in a way has also evolved with the need of having much more technology and professionalized operations behind any type of company, regardless of what they sell. Like, we started product school 10 years ago and still product management wasn't really a thing. There weren't really that many chief product officers. If anything, they were like glorified project manager with a cooler title called product. But now we look around and see so many companies with like a chief product officer with a dedicated career ladder competency model, like, and truly having much more influence over the strategy for the entire business. That's really good, I guess, for all of us.
Absolutely. It's interesting because product management kind of evolved out of, like, people were basically trying to solve some very specific kinds of problems, right? So there's, you know, in some cases it was a problem that the engineering teams had all this power and they were just trying to build stuff. And all of a sudden the CEO or the CXO team is like, hey, we need some people to kind of figure out where the market's going, figure out where the users are, and focus our investment on growth and the market itself. So product management sometimes came out of that requirement. There's other cases actually where product management came out of a requirement where the CEO was the founder and the CEO was the CPO. And over time, the company gets bigger and you need to sort of find a group of people to run the product. In other cases, to your point, product management came out of a need for just organizing projects. And all of the above is true, you know, and that's actually what sometimes makes this job really hard for a lot of people is the fluidity and the definition of it based on the company that you're in, the product lifecycle, a million other variables that can actually affect what your day-to-day job is as a product manager.
So I want to talk about the two main companies you work for, SAP. So you grew as a product leader and obviously now MicroStrategy. So on your LinkedIn profile, it says that you joined SAP as a senior product manager in 2003 in Paris. So please tell me more about what product management looked like back then.
Sure. Well, it's a case where the LinkedIn profile is actually a little bit misleading because of acquisitions that happened along the way. So the full story is I actually started in 2003 at a company called Crystal Decisions in Vancouver. And I was part of the product team for a product called Crystal Reports. And so I started my career in analytics way back there. And then a company called Business Objects bought Crystal Decisions. And Business Objects was a French company. So I ended up moving to France. And then a few years after that, SAP bought Business Objects. So it's been this like really interesting journey to get from, you know, Vancouver, Canada, all the way to Paris, France, working for a German company. I will say, though, you're asking about, you know, product management back then and what was the evolution of product management like. All of those companies were very different. So Crystal was a very developer-focused company and very embedded analytics, embedding into other products was a big part of what we did. And so product management was very technical. But then when you get to Business Objects was more business user-focused and departmental-focused. And so we had to evolve and bring in that sort of business expertise. And SAP was another thing altogether, which is a much larger company with a different product line because Business Objects was also a BI and analytics company, but SAP isn't, right? SAP is an ERP company that also had analytics as a key part of its portfolio. So all those things were completely different experiences and they were all great.
And I see that you went through multiple stages in the career rather, right? You became a senior director of product at SAP.
Mm-hmm.
So I would love to learn more about how was that leap for you, working as an individual contributor to then being in charge of a team, and what are the keys that you think that made you get that opportunity?
Yeah, it's actually a pretty hard question. So All right. So what was the leap like to go from individual contributor to, you know, having a team and having more products that you're responsible for? It was surprisingly elegant, I would actually say. It wasn't the leap that it sounds like, because it was incremental, right? So I went from one product and being an individual contributor to being in a team of like 3-4 people with like 4 or 5 products. And then I kind of grew from there. And so, the company actually gave me a really good opportunity to learn along the way. And one of the things that, for better or worse, most of the companies that I've worked at believed in is you do the job and then you earn the promotion and the title. And so in many of the cases, I had already kind of started doing the job, getting mentorship from really awesome people that I had a privilege to work with and work for, and kind of had started doing it anyways. And then the sort of promotion and the steps up the ladder, so to speak, more or less followed, I would say.
I love that, and I want to highlight it because I've done it in my company as well. Like a lot of the people who ended up getting promoted, they were leading already. They weren't waiting to get the promotion to start leading. And I think that's really good, actionable insight for others who might be thinking, okay, I'm an individual contributor. How do I really become a leader? When you start leading, you don't have to ask for permission. I'm sure your CEO or your CPO will appreciate that you are doing more.
100%. Actually, I will. Let's put an extra pin in it, even though you already did. There's another part to this, which is really important. And there's this phenomenon that happens really to a lot of people in every company. And I hope it doesn't happen to me anytime soon. But there's a real risk that people get overpromoted. Right? There's some level at which you're no longer good at your job potentially, right? And so it's really dangerous if you fight for a job that you haven't tried yet, get the job, and all of a sudden it turns out that you're not that good at it. It's very difficult to go back. It's difficult to go back from an ego perspective, from a compensation perspective, from a title perspective. And usually that doesn't end very well for the individual or for the company. So it's much better to be able to do the job, whether formally or informally, get comfortable, know if you even like it. And then when you're promoted into it, it's a natural step for everybody. Everyone knows you're going to be successful, or at least feels you're going to be successful. And you massively reduce your own personal risk of getting overpromoted as well.
It just reminded me of something that I learned in business school. It was called the Peter Principle. That's the maximum level of incompetence, right?
Yes, I know. Promoted
to the point that they just can't do it well enough.
Exactly. And really, we should always be afraid of that, right? Like you never want to be that person. And so, this is one way to combat it, is really just take on the job, do the job, and then it'll be clear whether or not you're competent to do it. And,
But you clearly were competent enough, because now you are chief product officer. So I see that when you join MicroStrategy, you joined as an SVP of product. So what are the differences between an SVP of product or VP of product and a chief product officer?
Yeah, well, actually, so I LinkedIn sometimes doesn't show all the steps entirely. So when I did join back at the end of 2016, I joined as the VP of product. And then I think I became SVP just 6 months later or something like this. In any case, I mean, those steps, the big difference between these things is truly just scope of responsibility and scope of ownership, right? The key really is, no matter what role you have, whether you're an individual contributor or a senior product manager or director or VP or any of those things, the only thing that really matters is, do you wake up every single day stressed and worried, in a sense, about making your product successful? And if you're fighting every single day to try to make your product successful, then the only difference between these levels is how many products you have, how big the product is, and how many people you have working for you to make those products successful.
I go to bed worrying a lot about the product, about the company, and sometimes thinking, who else is worrying so much? And I think it also gets to a point where you also want to share some of that responsibility. And when the product or the company is getting big, it's just natural to have more leaders, to be empowering those leaders so they can also carry the mental workload.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, Carlos, one thing one piece of advice I would give to people, or something just to keep in mind, is product management. The one thing I've always seen is everyone is always so busy, because you're at the center, you're at the nexus of, marketing and support and sales and engineering and the customer and all the stuff happening around you. And so product managers are always overloaded. It's just the way it is. And they always have more things that they have to do then they have time in the day to do them. And so a lot of product managers end up, their anxiety and their stress and their goals end up being around, can I get all my work done? And can I ship the product? But the real, you know, really good product managers, you know, they obviously worry about that a little bit, but the main goal is, how do I make my product successful? And those are subtly different things. Like, just getting your work done and making your product successful are not necessarily the same things.
I learned that something similar from Marissa Mayer when she was talking about the backlog and the to-do list and how it's easy to have a bigger to-do list than what it's physically able to be accomplished. And I learned to feel comfortable with that, to realize that it's okay. My goal is not to get to inbox zero, to-do list zero, Slack zero. It's to make sure that I can stay afloat by prioritizing what's most important, sometimes not for me, but for my team.
Right, exactly. And it's not easy. It's not easy. And it's not easy sometimes to ask yourself about every feature that you build or every meeting that you take, you know, how does this move the needle? Like, does this thing actually have an impact, or am I just overloaded with work that I'm just trying to, you know, get myself through?
So let's try to go deeper into the role of a CPO. So at that point, you physically do not have the time to really look into every detail, and it's necessary to delegate. So what if you were to look at only your calendar and kind of pick themes, like, where do you spend most of your energy these days?
That's a good question. I would say my time is fairly reasonably balanced. I mean, I try to make it as balanced as I can between time directly with customers, whether that's, you know, one-on-one meetings, physical meetings, Zoom meetings, or, you know, events that I go to, whether I'm presenting or whatever it might be. So, you know, a fairly reasonable chunk of time on that. Another equivalent amount of time often with, you know, product strategy, right? Like, where's the market? What are our, you know, what's our customers asking for? What are prospects potentially looking for? I'm trying to figure out, where are we winning? Where are we losing? And building a strategy for growth. That's another big chunk, I would say. Another big chunk is, I would call it, working with engineering people, right? Really just, you know, trying to marry up the product and market requirements with, you know, what's actually feasible, what are the right decisions to make from an architecture perspective, all the things you need to do when working with engineering. And the last part, I would say, is operational. And that's what people don't sometimes realize. Like, they think a CPO is just a pure strategy job. But, you know, listen, we have to ship and launch products. And so there's a fair amount of operational pieces to it. And also there's a fair amount of operational pieces that span all the other departments and organizations. And so a lot of it's, you know, connecting the dots and, you know, making sure there's alignment as much as possible between product and engineering and marketing and sales and support. And we're all rowing in the same direction. And that also takes, you know, a fair amount of time as well.
You want to make a comment on what you said about strategy, because that's something that resonates with me. I've seen that in more junior folks expecting that the strategy will be under off and they are just going to execute as if they couldn't contribute to strategy. The same way I've encountered candidates for positions in senior levels that expect that they are going to work on strategy, whatever that means, right? And then they will hand it off to others to make it happen. And as a founder, I just disagree with that state, you know. And yes, of course, I care and I'm very much involved in strategy, and I want to be involved in making sure it happens the same way I expect people to participate in that strategy and do not create just a line that says, and here's the strategist and here's everybody else.
Yeah. Well, there's so much I could say there. The first thing I'll say, I don't remember exactly who this quote is. It's probably some American general, but there's this quote that says, you know, no strategy survives first contact with the enemy, right? And really what that says is, we can come up with whatever strategies that we want, but it's the reality on the ground that really matters. And so you need to be able to loop back and forth between the reality on the ground and iterating on the strategy itself.
I was just thinking about Mike Tyson. I don't know why Mike Tyson is being quoted on strategy podcast.
Oh, really?
While I hear this quote that says, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. And it's so true.
Exactly. Same thing. Exactly right. And so you can't just be up here in your ivory tower. You really do need to be on the ground. It's funny, you actually mentioned, you know, I need to delegate and, you know, I can't be involved in all the details. I try to be, you know, because at the end of the day, like even little things like the wording in the product and the color of the buttons, like these things, you know, all do actually matter in terms of the experience. And so obviously I've got great people that do that work, and I'm not always, you know, able to go to the detail I would like, but I do care about all those things because I care about all the product.
Let's talk about that. Like, how do you go about deciding where are the areas where it actually matters to go as deep as necessary versus where are some of these other product decisions that you feel more comfortable delegating?
Well, actually, first of all, I wouldn't necessarily say deep is the opposite of delegate. You know what I mean? Like, I think when you've got a great team, they're doing great work. And so it's not a matter of whether you do the work yourself or you're delegating. Everyone has a role and everyone's doing their job. The areas that I feel like, you know, the CPO should get involved is when you need to connect the dots between different parts of your organization, right? Because you might have different leaders working together and they're trying to prioritize different parts of the portfolio. And sometimes those things need to work together. And sometimes they need to be trade-offs that they maybe don't feel comfortable making because they involve other parts of the portfolio. So one key area is obviously anything that touches multiple parts of the organization is something where, you know, you need to be involved. The other thing also is, you know, different products are in different parts of their life cycle. So products that are like newer require a bit more attention because there is less, I would call it inertia. There's less momentum driving that thing. And so a small course difference early on can have a huge impact in terms of where the product goes. And so any new product, you got to be on it right away because you have to sign up for wherever that thing ends up going, you see? And you have to course correct all the way. Whereas a product that's been around for 10 or 20 years, its trajectory is fairly well, it's kind of going. And now, you know, you don't need to spend quite as much detail time. And well, you do have to spend the same amount of detail time, but the effect of the detail time won't be quite the same. Does that make sense?
Totally. Another key area that I've seen a lot of executives invest time on is finance, is investing in their own team. So product specifically, we know it's relatively new, so there's not that many playbooks in terms of how to hire the right product manager. So love for you to share some of those principles or like what are the characteristics that you are looking for as you bring in new talent to your team.
Well, you know, it's funny. I was talking to someone that's in a role that's not so different than you. And what I mean by that is, you know, someone that has spoken to probably 1,000 product managers over his career. And him and I were sort of talking about it. And we definitely agreed on one thing. The one characteristic that almost will guarantee you a successful product manager versus an unsuccessful one is entrepreneurship. If they think like an entrepreneur, if they think like a founder and an owner of something, then they will most likely, I mean, sometimes people have different characteristics as well, but most likely that person will make a fantastic product manager because they're not in the silo of their department, right? Like you're the CEO. And guess what the CEO has to do? The CEO has to have a great product, has to have a great team, has to have great marketing, has to have great sales, has great customers. And you care about all of those things, right? Well, that's also true for a really great product manager. They have to think like a CEO. They have to think like an entrepreneur. And so that's what I look for as much as I possibly can. It's not easy to find.
It is not easy to find and it's not easy to retain either, right? Because yes, people with that type of ability, they need also the right environment to thrive. So how do you go about assuming you already found that hidden gem and you have that person on your team? Like, how do you create the right conditions for these people to thrive?
Well, you have to, I guess the main thing is if they feel like the thing is their baby, you have to give them as much freedom as you can to grow their baby, right? And that actually goes back to the other, when we talked about strategy and, you know, the difference between a strategy that comes from above and people inheriting strategy. At the end of the day, for a product manager, they have to own it. They have to feel attached to the strategy, to the product, to the thing. And that's really what I think has the biggest impact on retention is, does the product manager at any level, whatever level they're at, do they feel like they own this thing? And do they love it? And are they trying to make it successful? And do they feel personally insulted when their product isn't successful or somebody doesn't like their product? If they feel that way, if you can get people to feel that way, then I think everything works, right? They're going to be a great product manager. The odds of retention are higher because they're feeling fulfilled and they're enjoying their product and they're proud of it. And they don't really want to walk away from their product at that point.
And I want to also poke on that a little bit more and see how you feel when some of these people with a ton of potential and freedom to create got it wrong as part of the process, you know, and for the CPO as the ultimate person that is responsible for the health of the product, how do you go about, you know, treating that type of situation in a way that can be productive for the next iteration?
Well, you know something, I think I'll answer it in two different ways. The first is, sadly, I think we don't often know when it went wrong. Because when something goes wrong, what actually happens is you don't notice it, right? You build some feature, you think the feature is really important, five customers asked for it, you built the feature, those five customers are happy. Okay, and then you move on to the next thing, move on to the next feature, the next feature, the next feature. All of those might have been mistakes, right? Like we might have invested $1 million into something or $500,000 into something, and we pat ourselves on the back for shipping it, but then we don't look back to see if it grew or if that feature mattered. And so most of the time you don't know, actually. That's the first thing. And there's a lot of hidden investments that product managers make that are very expensive. You know, $1 million investments happen. Like when someone says this costs 100 points, you know, 50 points, man, you just spent $100,000. And did it have a 10x return? Do you even know? So a lot of it is we just don't know in most companies, actually. So the ones you do know are the ones that went pretty badly, right? They're the big ones, they're the ones you notice. And you deal with it. Like, listen, one of the things our CEO Fong, what he loves to say is like, listen, I don't want to look backwards. Let's just keep looking forward. And so if somebody makes a mistake, we make a mistake, but let's look forward. Do we learn from it? What do we do next? You know, no one's here to try to figure out ways to punish people. That's not really the goal, so.
I want to take you to another area, which is analytics. Obviously, MicroStrategy has been around for a long time and you've been in that area. Analytics is a very big word, right?
Yes.
So I'd love for you to help us better frame that and understand where MicroStrategy plays within analytics.
Yeah, so we play specifically in an industry that you would call business intelligence, okay? And it's very much about, you know, you've got data in a variety of different databases. You've got a bunch of operational systems and you're trying to figure out, well, how do I get that data? How do I analyze it? How do I build reports? How do I build dashboards? How do I embed it in products? How do I get it out to my users? And so we are very much in the business of connecting to all that data, organizing all that data, having the engines and what we call a semantic layer and data models to calculate on that data, and then downstream deliver that information on mobile devices, websites, you know, wherever you want to deliver it, reports, dashboards, and so forth as well.
So when you talk about embedded analytics, I can imagine that each customer thinks they're unique. They have their own specific needs. So how do you go about productizing something that is going to be custom pretty much by every single client?
Well, that's where, you know, the business that we're in, we're a platform. So we don't build and ship, you know, specifically financial services analytics. Although we serve some of the biggest financial services companies in the world. We don't build and ship retail specific analytics, although we serve some of the biggest retail companies in the world. And so we have a general purpose platform that's very, very flexible. And the whole idea is, you're right, all of these customers have very different requirements and they're trying to do something bespoke to differentiate or lead in their business area. And so our product is just it's a very flexible platform that allows you to, it's like, you know, we don't sell the food, but we sell all the big, you know, box of all the things you need to make the food.
Yeah, that's the whole premise of software as a service. Back in the day, I remember a lot of companies would try to build everything in-house, and now it's a whole new world where, yes, you still build certain elements in-house that maybe are extremely strategic or unique, but for the most part, especially in product, we tend to leverage what's already working and just customize on top of it. But like the aspect of analytics is the core of everybody's business, right? Like that's the thing that cannot fail because a lot of people depend on that to make decisions. Yeah. So it's always been nerve-wracking for me to think about, okay, like we're building a platform for so many different use cases. Now, just to make it even more fun, we have now artificial intelligence, which is also harder to control. So how do you include that now, artificial intelligence, in a way that it's helping clients make decisions faster, but also doesn't screw up their day?
Yeah, no, exactly. So in fact, a couple of things. One is, that's one of the biggest things that we did last year and one of the biggest investments that we continue to make is that we now have a product called MicroStrategy AI, which adds artificial intelligence functionality across our portfolio, basically. So you can use it to ask questions and get answers to all that data that we have in MicroStrategy. You can use it to, you know, automatically build visualizations and dashboards on top of the data that's trusted in MicroStrategy and so forth. And there's two key parts that are interesting. The first is the comment you made about using other people's services. So listen, we're not Google, we're not Microsoft. We're not going to build a multi-billion dollar LLM. So in fact, we use other people's LLMs. So we use Azure OpenAI is the first one that we started with, but we've also partnered with Google and US, and you know, we have plans to expand and use theirs as well. And the second thing I'll say is, you know, to your point about how do you make sure people can trust the data, we've got the data in MicroStrategy, which is a very, I would say, deterministic, precise way of calculating and managing information. The LLMs, on the other hand, they're probabilistic, right? They can hallucinate, they can do all these kinds of things. So what we actually do, which is, I think, really unique, and I sort of think of it as like the left and right side of the brain, we use the LLM for its cognitive capabilities, its linguistic capabilities, its ability to understand human beings and come up with plans, right? But then we marry that with our calculation capabilities and precision to actually go and run the queries, execute, run the calculations. And so you get this nice left and right brain kind of coming together, which is actually brand new in the industry, because before we only had one side or the other side. And by bringing them together, I think we're taking a pretty interesting step forward in the industry in terms of intelligence and analytics.
What do you think this next generation business intelligence product is going, now that more non-technical users will have the opportunity to access insights?
Yeah, so I think it really does come down to a few different things. On one side, there's all these new opportunities to leverage AI on top of this data to democratize information, as you sort of said, but also, you know, save people time from having to go and sort through things, look at a million things. And so there's also an acceleration that happens when AI and BI can, you know, alert you and give you the information that you need on the shop floor, like out there in the world, without having to go and slice and dice and pick up a dashboarding tool, right? So I think that's a pretty big difference. And on the other side, of course, you get tons of productivity improvements for all of the different personas involved as well.
Well, Saurabh, it's been great to spend this time with you and learn more about what your own career in product, how you think about strategy, hiring, and also data. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Carlos. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Product Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, it would mean the world to us if you would rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Taking the time to write just a few sentences about what you love most about the show will help us improve it and reach even more product people around the world. And when you're done, why not reward yourself with some free product management content and resources over at productschool.com? Until next time, stay product-led.